comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
And welcome to the Kevin Smith Show, whoever you are, wherever you are, all around this beautiful place we call Earth. Thanks for being here at the Kevin Smith Show. Talk radio like nowhere else on Earth. And it's the show where you matter. It's good to be back. You know, all last week I was away from the microphone. I was working every day, but I cut my schedule back to 10 hours a day. And I was not at the microphone, and that's the longest continuous period of time that I've not been at the microphone, ever. Even back in 2007 when I had the stroke on Friday, missed the show Monday, Tuesday I was back on the show, and so I only missed one show. But it's good to be back. I feel a little bit, it's almost like stage fright, because I don't know that I'm going to push all the buttons in the right order. I'm out of practice. Our new members area is open and functioning, and it is getting rave reviews, and I'm glad it is. I want to thank, and look, you know who you are. This could not have happened without support from the audience, and you know who you are that donated to make this happen. Thank you on behalf of everybody, and because it made it possible for us to get this spiffy new software that's running the members area, and as I said, it is getting rave reviews. Speaking of rave reviews, those of you who have listened to the show for any length of time know that one of my favorite rock bands is a band called Element 115. Element 115 happens to be local here in the Phoenix area, but I was a fan of Element 115 before I even knew that they were local to Phoenix. They're a really unique band. They're the only rock band I know of that has an alien for a drummer. And they have the opportunity to open up for Kiss in a concert here in the Phoenix area. And there's a contest going on to see what band is going to get to open up. And whichever band gets the most votes in this contest gets to be the opening act for Kiss at their concert in September. I have voted for Element 115. I hope you will. Look, a lot of folks say, well, I don't even live in Phoenix. What does it matter? Look, it matters because Element 115 are part of our family as well. So let's get behind them, and it doesn't cost you anything. It takes maybe 20 seconds to go vote for them. The link is on my website. Look right under where it says Listen Live. Look right under that. You'll see something about helping Element 115 get the gig. Just click that. It'll take you to the site and where you can vote for them. And right beside, they're in the number 2 spot. Just click where it says demanded and vote for them. Really do this, okay? And really, as a favor to me, go click that button. We'll be back with John Anthony West right after this. Welcome. welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. As those on the radio heard, this is my first night back after a week away from the mic. And I made the comment that, you know, I got a little bit of stage fright because I'm not sure I'll push all the right buttons. And apparently I didn't have all the right buttons pushed during that first 5 minutes. But and people watching on video on our TV channel were not getting audio. Sorry about that. Pilot error. But anyway, we are back. And let me say very quickly, because of that, one of the things that I encouraged people to do during that first 5 minutes is please go to my website, kevinsmithshow.com. When you get to the website, look right under where it says Listen Live, and you'll see some links. And one of them has the name Element 115. That's a rock band. They're part of our family here at the Kevin Smith Show, and it's the only rock band I know of anywhere that has an alien drummer. That's not a joke. They have an alien drummer. But click on that and vote for them to help them be the opening act for Kiss in concert here in Phoenix in September. My guest this evening is John Anthony West. He is described as a rogue Egyptologist and mystic in skeptic's clothing. He's been studying and writing about ancient Egypt for four decades. He is the foremost exponent of the symbolist school of Egyptology, which sees an ancient sacred science where modern academics see superstition and demonstrates that there is an ancient sacred science. His work on redating the Great Sphinx of Giza via geology, proving that it must be at least 10,000 years old or older, was the subject of a 1993 NBC special called The Mystery of the Sphinx, hosted by Charlton Heston, viewed by 30 million people. This was one of the most successful documentaries ever shown, and it escalated into heated international scholarly controversy. John Anthony West won an Emmy in 1993 for Best Research for his work on the video, and the show itself was one of four nominated for Best Documentary Program. He's been with us before. I'm delighted to welcome him back. John Anthony West, welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show.
Why, thank you, Kevin, and it's a pleasure to be back.
John, it's been a long time since you were with us on the show, and obviously you haven't just been sitting around during that period of time. I know you to be a very, very busy individual, and one of the things that you have done, and I am hopeful that you'll share this with us, you made a recent trip to this archaeological site called Göbekli Tepe in Turkey, and you found out some pretty interesting things there. Tell us about that, if you will.
I'll be happy to. Actually, it's not that we found out, but really we verified.
Okay.
To our own satisfaction. This is a place, it's in southeastern Turkey, about 40 miles north of the Syrian border. And Göbekli Tepe actually means in Turkish, not that I speak Turkish, but fortunately we had a good friend of mine who is Turkish, a Turkish doctor who lives in Connecticut, with us to smooth the way, because otherwise, I tell you, finding somebody in southeastern Turkey who speaks English is a bit like finding somebody who speaks Turkish in Saugerties, New York, where I live. It would have been a disaster. We might have found our way to the site, but boy, it wouldn't have been much fun. Anyway, so we had some with it. But Göbekli Tepe actually means that they, when you read, if you pull it up, if you Google it up, and this is worth doing for the audience, and you spell it G for George, O E, B for boy, E, K for king, L for lion, I. Göbekli Tepe, T for Thomas, E, P for Peter, E. Göbekli Tepe. And that in Turkish, they translate it as belly hell, which means absolutely nothing. If you understand what's going on at this place, even at the most primitive level, what it really means is the umbilical cord, the umbilical hill, the place of creation, as it were. So then suddenly, I mean, as belly hill, why should anybody build anything there? If it's the place where creation symbolically takes place, then you're looking at something very different. Anyhow, this is a site discovered about 50 years ago, but nobody paid any attention. It's in a rather deserted part of Turkey, and it's a hill, and a few hills around, and lots of plains around. And when it was first discovered, they found lots of old flint things, arrowheads and that sort of thing, but nobody wanted to dig. And then in the 90s, for reasons I'm not quite sure of, that they decided to dig there. Oh, I know why, yes. It's not that they decided to dig. It's that the local farmers, and it's very dry there, it's very arid, so there's not much farming going on, but anyway, whoever owned the land was plowing and hit a rock. And he tried to move the rock out of the way, and the rock didn't move, and so he plowed again, hoping to dislodge this rock. And the rock wasn't moving, it was just denting the plow. So then they decided they wanted to get this rock out of the way so they could plow and plant their pistachio trees or whatever it was that they were planting. So they started digging, and it wasn't a rock, it was a big slab that was standing upright. So they decided, and now they're very sorry they did this, because the government stole all their property from them. They discovered that it was a big, you know, man-made slab. And so they went and they got the government, and the government went and got the archaeologists that worked, and specifically a man named Klaus Schmidt, a German archaeologist, and they started digging. This is about, I think, 97 or 98. And digging goes slowly with archaeology. So they've been working on this place now for 13 years, and they have about 5% of it dug up. And they know from ground-penetrating radar and maybe seismographs, I'm not sure about the seismographs, but anyway, various devices, technologies that allow them to look underground, take an underground x-ray, that they've got only about 5% of this site dug up. And what they have so far is five or six, I forget exactly the number, of absolutely spectacular mini Stonehenges. They look very like Stonehenge in the sense that they're similar construction. You have two quite massive stone slabs in the center, not as big as Stonehenge, but 10, 15 tons, and those central pillars. And then two rings of smaller pillars around them. And there are four or five of these, and they're each slightly different. And the stone pillars themselves come from a quarry about three-quarters of a mile away downhill. And the biggest of the pillars, the central pillars, weigh 10 to 15 tons. So this is already, you're not dealing with primitive stuff here. And they're carved with absolutely fabulous carvings, high-relief carving. High-relief means, as opposed to cutting a figure into the stone, you cut the stone away, the surface of the stone away, to reveal the raised relief of whatever it is that you're doing. This is very difficult to do this kind of work. And the cruncher for us is that this isn't done at a time, at a period, let's say, corresponding to dynastic Egypt. It's not 3000 BC, and it's not 2000 BC, and it's not 1000 BC, when you might expect this kind of work coming out of a, you know, fairly advanced civilization such as Turkey was. But the archaeologist in charge, who is a meticulous worker, and believe me, he would not be putting forth a date like this if there were any doubts about it, he puts the date at least 10,000 B.C. Now, that's the reason why we went there. It's that dating. If it were not the dating, then it would be a major archaeological discovery, but it wouldn't take our own work, let's say, any further one way or the other, because in Egypt, let's say 2000 BC or 1000 BC, they're doing quite spectacular stuff in Egypt, so this wouldn't be anything unusual. However, at 10,000 BC, this turns all of archaeology upside down, because one of the arguments we always get for our Sphinx theory, and I guess I'll get into this in a bit, but I'm not sure how much of your audience knows about our Sphinx theory, but just briefly in a sentence, our geological studies, myself and my colleague Robert Schott, geologist at Boston University, have demonstrated to the satisfaction basically of the geological community of the world that due to the water weathering on the body of the Sphinx, it has to be a lot older than it's supposed to be. It's supposed to be about 2500 BC, but because of its water weathering, it has to have been built at a much earlier stage when there was water around in Egypt to weather it that way, when it's just wind and sand can't happen. So anyway, one of the arguments always thrown up against us is that, well, how can the Sphinx be as old as you say it is? It was all hunter-gatherers back in that kind of time. Nobody was building massive stone structures, so your theory is useless, even though the geologists all agree that it is water weathering, and therefore it has to be older. So for us, this is hugely important. And we went there, Schock and myself and his wife, really in order to check out for ourselves. Klaus Schmidt, the archaeologist in charge, because we've got stuck a couple of times before where we thought we had evidence and we had people with correct credentials supporting the evidence, and we went there ourselves. We said, no, unfortunately, that can't be supported. But in this case, we're dealing with a guy who's an absolutely meticulous worker. He's the one who's put the dating on, not sort of New Age outsiders. And that dating of 10,000 B.C. means that at a time when there's only supposed to be hunter-gatherers, and maybe they were hunter-gatherers and didn't farm, because why should you farm if there's plenty of food floating around and fish swimming around? Who in their right mind would farm if you didn't have to?
Mm-hmm.
Go out and hunt and catch fish.
Okay, but let me ask you a question now.
Yeah.
You were able, when you went to Göbekli Tepe, to verify the date that the archaeologist had put on this find. Is that correct?
Well, no. In other words, we didn't have to redo the science, but when the methodology that Schmidt used is there for everybody to check out. And so by checking out the methodology and seeing it for ourselves and understanding what was involved in this, I mean, it's a combination of carbon dating for the fill that was put in around the site itself. I mean, lots of mysteries about this site. It was constructed somewhere around, or at least the part that's been excavated, because there are lots more of this. There are these four or five stone circles, but it's known there are at least 22 more structures, and whether or not they're stone circles, we don't know, but there's a ton of stuff there. I mean, it's an amazing site. And so, and then it was deliberately covered up for reasons absolutely nobody understands, and we can't even imagine what it is, but it's quite clear that it was deliberately covered over, because if we're just covered over by the wind and the sand and lots of time, that would be a different kind of fill, but it's covered up with fill that's been brought from somewhere, and that's, the fill has organic matter in it, so the fill dates to about 8,000 BC, and then the stone pillars themselves, once they're covered over, then it rains, of course, and they're in moist soil, and the moisture of the soil creates what are called in geology mini stalactites, tiny little crystalline structures that form on the stone itself. And these have organic matter in them that can be dated. So it's that gives the 10,000 BC date.
Okay, but now what strikes me, and we've got about 2.5 minutes here until break, but what strikes me is this site then dates from about the same period of time that you and Dr. Schock determined the date for the Sphinx.
Maybe. I personally discussed this. I actually think the Sphinx is a lot older than that, but for argument's sake, let's say it's at least that old.
Well, that means then that you have two rather spectacularly advanced civilizations.
That's right.
In separate areas, hundreds of miles from each other.
Well, I mean, close enough. The point is actually that with our Sphinx theory, we were sitting there all by ourselves. The fact, I mean, the geology itself, honestly, Kevin, you have to know what it's like dealing with crackademics to understand how frustrating this is. Because the geology in and of itself is enough to prove our point. But when you're dealing with crackademics, that's not good enough. So the argument always was, well, yeah, the geologists all agree with you, but what do they know about archaeology and Egyptology? And we say this is impossible because it's all hunter-gatherers back then. So now suddenly, and it may well be hunter-gatherers, except they were hunter-gatherers who could wrestle 15-ton blocks of stone up a hill from a quarry half a mile away, set it up in place, build two stone circles around it, and then carve into these extraordinary, into these big blocks, carving in high relief. Now, high relief, it means you have to, the carving protrudes from the surface of the block. So you have to carve the block away in order to free the figure, in this case.
Yeah, it's like a sculpture.
Well, it is a sculpture.
Mm-hmm.
But there are two ways that high relief, which is you carve the surface away to, let's say, in order to create the sculpture that protrudes from the surface, or you carve into the sculpture, you carve into the block, which is, I mean, it's also not easy, but it's a lot easier than the high relief. So here you have...
All right, we have to step away for a break, and we'll be back right after this, folks. Tell you what, 1 week away from the live show, and I forget all the buttons to push, and I am frantically in here saying, what comes next? Jerry Wills can tell you about this. Okay, my guest is John Anthony West, and John, when we had to step away for break, you were talking about the way these things are sculpted.
Right.
And the different, one way is you cut the mark into the stone.
Right.
And the other way is you cut the surface away to leave the mark standing out from the stone.
Exactly. And now you have to remember that as far as anybody knows now, assuming that the dating is correct and we have absolutely, we're convinced that the Schmidt's dating techniques are impeccable. And so, I mean, if even the archaeologists are accepting the dating, you can be sure that it's unchallengeable, because they don't like this one little bit, because it completely destroys their paradigm of how and when civilization began. I mean, it doesn't begin in Egypt and Sumeria and China and India somewhere around 3000 BC. It's taking place at a very sophisticated level, at least as early as 10,000 BC, with a technology that that's pretty mind-boggling, because there's no metal that anyone knows of. It's bad enough in Egypt where they're carving granites and diorites and hard stones, apparently with copper tools, which is a big mystery in its own right.
Mm-hmm.
Here, as far as anyone has been able to discover, there's no metal at all. So they're carving these things somehow or another with flint instruments. And this is mind-boggling. Nobody knows how they could have done it. And if you Google it up, and I mean, all listeners are advised to Google up Göbekli Tepe, because I can talk from now till doomsday about it, but until you actually see the photos, and there are lots of them up on the web already, you really don't get an appreciation of what's involved. So the...
Now, do you have any photographs of this site on your website?
Not yet. We took loads of photographs and shot. My colleague is busy sorting out and, you know, picking out from the millions of photos that we took the ones that we want up on our respective websites. So they're not up there yet. But if you just Google it up, just go to you know, you just Google it, Göbekli Tepe, and click a button, and you'll get, you know, you'll get plenty of illustrative material. So the artistic quality of these reliefs is as good as anything that shows up in Egypt 7,000 and 8,000 years later. I mean, it's brilliant. I mean, it's meticulously realized, and it's artistically fantastically sophisticated. As wild boar and cranes and foxes and lizards and snakes and all kinds of things, and nobody knows, including us, what these represent. Schmidt, who, as I said, I mean, Schmidt is an absolutely orthodox archaeologist, but of the best sort, meticulous worker, not, as far as I can gather, not particularly interested in the metaphysical, esoteric side of things that interests me primarily. But in any event, I mean, the best kind of scientific worker. And so he doesn't know. I mean, it's understood that this whole site plays some sort of a ceremonial purpose, and they've discovered lots of animal bones around, so it's quite clear they're having feasts and all of that. Shock and I think that almost certainly, because they are stone circles, there has to be some sort of astronomical significance. Schmidt doesn't think so initially, but he might change his mind when we get to know each other better, because he says, because all of the sites, all of these stone circles, the four or five that have been excavated up to now, have different orientations. So he thinks that they're not astronomical. We think that the different orientations may be because each of the sites are built in order to be able to sight in on different kinds of astronomical configurations, but we don't know that either. In other words, it's still an open question. But from our point of view, the question that is no longer open is that it's impossible now to say that the Sphinx, our whole idea, our whole theory of an older Sphinx, is impossible, because it's all hunter-gatherers and there's no sophisticated civilization. Here's a site, a major site, only 5% excavated, that the archaeologists in charge, who are not New Agers or, you know, alternative thinkers or anything of the sort, absolutely rigorous, orthodox archaeologists, and they put the dating at 10,000 BC. So our whole theory is now, not that it directly validates our theory, but it directly contradicts the argument that we've been getting for the last 20 years that, oh, well, it's impossible because it's all hunter-gatherer. So for us, this is hugely important, and we are pretty well sure that our video done in 93, I don't know, did you ever see that, Mr.?
Oh, yeah, I've seen it several times.
Okay, well, media, TV networks have been asking us for years for a sequel to that, Son of Mystery of the Sphinx. But we haven't had, actually we have lots more evidence that isn't presented in that original show, but none of it is, it's convincing and important from the archaeological and Egyptological point of view, but not from the visual point of view. So unless it's visually exciting, it's very difficult to get particularly a commercial television, be it cable or network, behind you. But now here we have Göbekli Tepe. So now we've got a sequel. We've got something going that really is worthy of becoming a sequel. And we're hoping that this, I mean, once this is up, the major argument against us disappears, and the quackademic community is just going to have to accept it or be subject to an awful lot of ridicule, which, in fact, I'm quite good at. So, we'll see what happens.
Well, I think those who dish out the ridicule deserve to have it served back.
Oh, yeah, they don't like it, though.
Yeah, well, who cares?
So much the better. I'm very happy that they don't like it.
But, I think this is important to point out, that I like the term you use, crackademic. In the
quackademic,
yeah. In the quackademic world, are in that pool of people out there of establishment science, there are some gems. There are some who say, look, let's just let the data take us where the data takes us. The data says what it says.
That's right.
And apparently this archaeologist that you're talking about is of that sort. And those are the people that cause us to make progress. It's the others who try to hang on to what they learned 50 years ago in university. Those are the ones that keep us from progressing.
Well, the history of science, starting with Galileo, has always been that way. So anybody mm-hmm. who comes up with anything that is seriously new and challenging, no matter what the nature of the evidence, is confronted by this ivory tower behind a stone rampart. And
well, now I have a theory, and this theory is not exactly tailored to the Sphinx and to your theory, but it sort of comes from it, and it's this. Whatever is going to be possible 1,000 years from now is possible now and always has been. All that it's waiting on is for somebody to think the right thoughts to get there. So everything that ever will be possible is possible now and was possible to infinity in the past.
Oh, I'm not so sure of that.
I think so. Now, that doesn't mean that the technology existed, but it means that the people could have thought the thoughts that led them to the technology.
Oh, yeah. Oh, sure. Okay.
You see?
They have to think the thoughts that lead them to the technology.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that goes without saying. However, what those thoughts were, you know, listen, you've ever been to Egypt, Kevin, have you?
No, I haven't.
Yeah, well, see, Egypt is like sex. People always say, well, what do you mean by that? Well, you can read all about it, and you can look at pictures, but until you've experienced it, you don't understand a thing about it.
Mm-hmm.
So when the argument is on the page, well, all right, you can make coherent sense of the argument. But when you actually see what they did under the circumstances with, as far as we know, no known technology that would allow them to do this kind of work, you kind of scratch your head and say, well, yeah, I mean, it's clear that it's been done. And in the case of Göbekli Tepe, for example, and Schmidt doesn't even... I mean, he doesn't even question seriously the miracle of producing these incredible sculptures. Quarrying the rocks out of the bedrock is, oddly enough, that's not the biggest job, but carving them with apparently nothing other than flint tools is sort of miraculous. And then there are even little things. And, you know, he's showing us, or his second-in-command was showing us some of the things that they found. And one of the things that they found was a little bead that was obviously part of a necklace, maybe, let's say, 3/4 of an inch by 3/4 of an inch, a little flat slab. And it had a little hole about, let's say, maybe a 16th of an inch across, drilled through long ways in this very hard stone, which I think was a basalt or something like that. Now, they asked me about this. They always said they used a flint burr and, you know, a little sharply pointed tool. But when you know what's involved in this, and evidently this was part of a necklace, you'd think it was a whole thing of this. Well, no. How the hell we would need a vise and a power drill, a very hard diamond drill or something like that. And this little flat bead, perfectly in place to drill a precise hole right through it lengthwise. See, this is a piece, it's a little thing, an inch, it's 3/4 of an inch on either side. But this is a major piece of technology. How the hell did they do this?
Well, but see, that's what I'm getting at with whatever... Yeah. Whatever ever will be possible has always been possible. The thoughts that we think have brought us to our technology that we use. Now, let me show you how this works, and it's really your work that made me think of this.
Yeah.
I've heard lots and lots and lots and lots of experts say that we could not build the Great Pyramid today. But they thought thoughts that enabled them to do it, and so it was possible for them when we think it's not possible for us. Yet if it was possible, it must still be. We have to step away for a break. I'll give you a chance to take a shot at that when we come back. Don't go away, folks. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening, John Anthony West. John, when we went away for break, I was making a point that their way of thinking, their thoughts about science enabled them to do the Sphinx, enabled them to do the Great Pyramid.
Yeah. Right.
Okay. Now, our way of thinking about science does not enable us to do that. But the point is, it was possible.
Yes.
Okay, and so that's why I say that whatever has been possible, whatever will be possible, is possible now. It's possible at all times, and the key is the thinking.
Well, yes, theoretically, this is true, but we don't know, for the most part, we don't know how they thought. I mean, this is why
that's why your work is so interesting, because you talk about the sacred science.
Yes.
In Egyptology, and you're getting into the mind of the people there.
Insofar as that's possible, yes. And it's what I said before, that it's so important to actually experience it, because here on radio, it's just words. I mean, it's the best we can do. It's a great medium. I mean, if we're on television, okay, then there are pictures. But even that, until you're actually confronted by these things, and you're in the middle of them, and particularly if you've studied them for a long time, so you actually have a sense of what's going on, it's not just intellectually exciting, it's emotionally enlightening. You're confronted by works that, and it's not just the size of them, but it's a combination of, you know, this unbelievably precise stonework and the magnitude of the volume of these incredible things, and you're struck with a real sense of what a genuine civilization was once like before there were shopping malls and Disneyland and Walmarts. It's such a different mindset to our own, or the mindset, heart set, you might say, soul set, that what you're saying is quite right, actually, Kevin. You know, that if it was possible for them, it's possible for us. But we have to understand where they were coming from, their frame of mind. And this is, and then not only that, then we have to be able to understand how the devil it was that they did these things, because nothing that we have, you can say that if it were important enough to us, we can fly to the moon. I mean, we can do pretty cool technological things. So if it was really important to us, we could figure out a way to build a temple of 200-ton blocks of stone like temples around the Sphinx, or we could figure out a way to build the Great Pyramid. I'm pretty sure we could do this. But unless we put our minds to it, given our present technology, no, we could not do it. We can fly to the moon, but we could not build a pyramid with anything that we have now. We couldn't. So then you're confronted by, okay, well, how did the ancients do it? And then maybe even more important from my point of view, why on earth did they do this incredible stuff? And
yeah, because the answer to why takes you into their mind.
That's right. But we don't know why.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know why. All you can say, ballparking it, you can say with real, I mean, even the quackademics wouldn't argue with this. They would just say that it's superstition. And I say, no, it's not superstition, it's knowledge. Egypt is a one-issue civilization. The entire civilization is geared toward a particular spiritual, philosophical, metaphysical concept, the immortality of the soul. This is what all of their religious architecture is directed at. So when you look at a pyramid, or you look at a temple of Luxor, or any piece of artwork that's there, it all has that underlying motive. That's what they were after. Now, for us, this is, I mean, it's very difficult to get into that mindset.
Mm-hmm.
But you can say with certainty that that's what they were after. So you then can go, well, okay, if that's what's involved, then all of their creative genius, all of their creative talents are going toward the realization of that goal in religious or metaphysical art and architecture. And you can actually, you don't need any history, almost no history, to understand, really, to get a sense of what civilization is, or how societies are, or where they're coming from. Historians, however knowledgeable they may be in terms of facts, all have their own agendas. So they're all trying to prove that it's progress, or it's communist, or it's not communist, or it's religious, or it's this, that, and the other. But if you want to really understand the civilization, you look at, you don't even have to know anything, you just look at where they directed their creative energies. And so Egypt is maybe the best example of this, because there's so much of it left. And so you see that all of their creative energies, it's not that they didn't go to war or, you know, have their problems or whatever, but basically their creative energies all went to furthering this concept of the immortality of the soul. And then you look at any other civilization, choose your civilization at will, and look at where they put their creative energies, and you'll get a good sense of the civilization. Let's say, take Renaissance Italy. Well, a lot of it went into art and architecture, into beauty. A lot of it was the glorification of the ego. It's all, particularly at the Michelangelo, the High Renaissance, it's look at me, what a genius I am.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they were. They were geniuses.
Yeah.
But it has this, let's say, this ego-enhancing quality, whereas Egypt doesn't. It's everything's anonymous. You don't know who did anything. And then you look at us. Where do we put our creative energies? What, 60%, let's say, 60, 70% into the military, into weapons, into murdering other people, as many as we possibly can without endangering ourselves. 25% maybe into stupidity and frivolity, into bobblehead dolls and Disneyland and
mm-hmm.
Hollywood and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe, what, 8%, 10% into real science, into medicine, into stuff that is actually enhancing, life-enhancing but practically none of it, almost none of it, into the immortality of the soul. Correct?
Well, that's true.
Well, that tells you where a civilization is coming from. So, for us to comprehend where they are coming from requires, I mean, a major step in humility. Actually, you have to sort of say, well, gee, we can see that this is what they're doing. And again, you have to be very careful. When the more you know, in terms of the more education you have, in a sense, the less liable you are to understand. If I may quote myself, modern education is to the mind, this is in my astrology book, modern education is to the mind what AIDS is to the immune system. The more exposure you have to it, the more likely it is to be lethal. So you have to be really careful, because all of us are programmed. We can't help it. And the only way you can get away from being programmed is to know that you are programmed. So we you know, we take progress as a given. And it's only when you actually, something drops into the slot. With me, very early, I realized that I'd been born into a madhouse and into a lunatic asylum, and that the whole society, that it was all baloney, and everything that I was being taught was rubbish. It wasn't that it was necessarily factually rubbish, but it wasn't progress. It was shiny barbarism. And when I started getting interested in these things, which was a long time ago, you know, I first walked into the Cathedral of Chartres. I was in the army in Germany in the 50s and walked into this place, and you know, was absolutely blown out of my mind. It was clear to me that somebody knew something, despite the horrors of the church and the awfulness of institutionalized religion. Whoever put this thing together was in some state of being that was, to me, virtually unimaginable, except that I could experience it. So,
well, do you think maybe these ancients, this is just a stab in the dark, and I'll have to get you to answer this when we come back from break, but do you think maybe they focused more on why, where we focus more on how? We'll get your answer to that when we come back. Don't go away, folks. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. Just as we went to break, I asked the question, John, do you think maybe these ancients were focused a bit more on why, and we're focused a lot more on how?
I'm not sure. They were also focused on how because of the amazing things that they did. It was not actually. I don't think they asked themselves that way. They were living at a different level of consciousness. Things that to us are sort of separate. You know, it's us and the world, as it were. To them, they were a part of it all. And I'll give you a couple of examples, actually, of things, because I've always been fascinated by this question. How did they know the stuff that they knew? And, again, this is a thing that you never get. I mean, the question is never raised in our educations. But, for example, not too long ago, a couple of years ago, I was in South America, in Brazil, with a remarkable guy doing a couple of weeks of ayahuasca sessions. You know what ayahuasca is, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, so these were very interesting, and definitely not for the faint of heart. I'm not so sure I'd want to do it again, but very valuable. But the guy who was leading these sessions, I was a speaker at a kind of he ran a retreat for people doing these, doing a 2 weeks worth of ayahuasca sessions, and I was, you know, I was talking about Egypt. And so I had the whole thing laid on for me, and there was a brilliant guy who was running it, who was I mean, he was a shaman, and you know, but he was not in the rainforest. We were in a nice, simple place, but at my age, I can do without jungle hammocks and mosquitoes in the jungle. If that were the only way to do it, I'd do it, but still, I prefer a bit of comfort. And he was a PhD in cultural anthropology, Colombian by birth, but spent years and years and years working in the rainforest. And so he gave us, you know, a lot of information about how the ayahuasca is, how it's created. And it comes from two completely unobtrusive-looking vines that grow in the rainforest. And the vines don't grow anywhere near each other. And they're, I mean, there are people who know about these things, there are 90,000 different plants in the rainforest. And these two are about as undistinguishable as plants can be from each other, and they also don't grow anywhere near each other. And in order to make this stuff work, one of the plants has the psychoactive substance in it, and the other plant is what fixes it so that it's digestible in a way, because if you only had one, let's say the psychoactive one, all you do is get violently sick, instantly your body would reject it and it wouldn't have any effect. So it needs the other plant to fix it so that you can actually get it down, sort of. And then it has, takes about an hour for it to kick in. And then there it is. But the preparation of these things is not easy. First you have to gather the stuff, and then you have to beat it with hammers, rocks, whatever they have to beat it up, and boil it a number of times at a certain, in exactly the right sort of way, in order to produce the substance that works. Now, there is no possible, conceivable way that you can arrive at that by trial and error. You can't. You have to, the shamans or whoever it was that develops it, have to somehow access, for lack of a better word, the soul of the plant, and then somehow understand that it has to go through this process in order to become the psychoactive alloy, or what you might, let's say, compound that it is. Same kind of thinking applies, let's say, with a much better known example, acupuncture.
Mm-hmm.
You stick a needle in your toe and your kidney gets better. Well, there's no way that you can kind of accidentally discover this. What, you're walking along, somebody's walking along and they barefoot because they don't have shoes back then, and they step on a thorn, and the next day they say, kidney feels better. Well, let's see what happens if I stick another thorn in my ear. And, oh, well, liver gets better. No, can't be. Whoever devises that system, I mean, once you have the basics, yeah, then you can maybe go, you can extrapolate and go by trial and error. But the basic understanding has to come from a level of knowledge that to us, we don't have. I mean, I certainly don't have it. I mean, certain kinds of maybe sensitive people might have such knowledge. But all of the ancient world, all of these things we've been talking about, Göbekli Tepe, all of this stuff, is advanced knowledge of a kind that really, if we stop and think about it, is unimaginable to us. They access, when you were talking about before, well, what was possible for them is possible for us. Yes, in theory, if we could think their way.
That's it.
But thinking their way, the more you know about it, and, you know, I've spent 40 years doing this, so I really do know about as much about it as you can know, given our level of knowledge. But I'm continually, endlessly mystified by this problem of when you say, well, it's the why, not the how. No, it's neither, actually, Kevin. It's
just a whole different way of thinking.
Somewhere else. It's,
uh-huh.
To them, it's technology, and to us, it's magic. And it's a very high order of magic because, as I said, it has this emotional content. You can be sure 5,000 years from now, if there's anything left from this stupid civilization, if somebody runs across a Walmart or a Disneyland, it's not going to give them an emotional hit. Somebody's going to say, whoa, this is pretty cool. Wow, who are these amazing people that produced this? If there's anything left and people have any intelligence, they'll say, who the hell would bother to do some stupid junk crap like this?
So, well, I don't think we've built anything that's going to last for the next few thousand years like these.
No, I don't think so either.
These giant stone structures.
Years.
Let me ask you, do you have a theory about either this very ancient Egyptian, and they may not be ethnically Egyptian, but that geographical area, do you have a theory about who these people were that had this amazing, I'm going to say, science? Any idea who they were?
No, not really. But actually, it's quite clear that whoever they were, other people also had it. In other words, What's going on at Göbekli Tepe, even if we don't really understand it, just the level of the artwork and the let's say the drive to produce these stone circles, with no tools that are possibly available. And then you look around and you look at what's left of the doctrines, because what's so interesting about Egypt, what makes it so important is not that necessarily it's a higher civilization than other places. What makes it important for us is that you can visit it and experience it, whereas, let's say, you can't experience China 3000 B.C. or India 3000 B.C., but it's clear from the text that the same doctrine prevails in, is in a different, let's say, a different aspect of it in all of these different civilizations. So something is going on a global level very early. And, I mean, I think you can safely say, even in terms of rigorous scholarship, back it up, that the idea that we're spiritual beings, that, in other words, that the immortality of the soul is not a figment of the primitive imagination, but rather the fundamental significance of our own human existence. And those people back then knew this, even if they were seriously hunters and gatherers. They might well have been, however, they were hunters and gatherers who could create these extraordinary artistic masterpieces. And believe me, creating an artistic masterpiece, primitives don't do that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you have to have artistic creation. You see, we live in a society in which practically nobody is able to make a living out of their own creative talents. Almost nobody. And those who manage to do it at great cost to themselves. Practically everyone works in some kind of a stupid job that they hate getting up in the morning to do and would much rather be doing something else. And yet all of us have this innate creativity. We're born with it. But the nature of our church of progress, of our shiny barbaric society, is that almost nobody makes a living out of creativity, and those who do it out of either maniacal creativity, like you spend your day devising some new nerve gas or some kind of new predator drone that wipes people out by just pressing a button from 7,000 miles away. And I don't know, maybe you feel proud of yourself. You come home and you say to your wife, hey, honey, you see the thing I invented today? You press a button and we can destroy 5,000 people over in Pakistan. Maybe that makes them feel good. I don't know. Wouldn't make me feel good. Or you come back and you devise some new stupid thing for Disneyland. Or
well, and the proof of what you're saying is if there's a great cataclysm tomorrow that takes down the electric grid.
Right.
If that happens, we're hunters and gatherers.
Yeah, except that we don't know how to hunt and we don't know how to gather and there's not much left to gather.
That is the truth.
You bet.
All right, I want to open up the telephone lines
okay.
and invite our audience to join us. and invite our audience all around the world to join us. The telephone is open, folks, and the telephone number is 623-444-5889. That's the main number here in the studio. It will work from anywhere on this planet. 623-444-5889. Now, if you're in the USA or Canada and you need to call me on toll-free, you can do so. It is 888-223-4599. If you have a plan where it costs you nothing to make a long-distance call, then please use our main number. 623-444-5889. Now, if you're outside of the USA and you're outside of Canada, you can send me a flash message or you can call our main number, okay? Either one. To send me a flash message, all you have to do is go to my website and scroll down. You'll see a link that says flash message and you can send me your question or comments that way. But you have to be outside the USA or Canada. We provide that because we don't have an international toll-free number, okay? So if you're in the USA or Canada, give us a call on the telephone. One of the things that people very often think about when they think about these marvelous creations of the ancients, whether they were Egyptian or whoever they were, but in the area of modern day Egypt, they think about these marvelous creations. They think about how precise these structures are laid out. We're going to take a call, and then I want to talk with you about the specificity of the layout of some of these things. All right, caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hi, Kevin. It's Stefan, Quebec City. Glad to have you back on track.
Well, I'm back. I don't know if I'm back on track. You know, being away from the controls for the live show for a week, I'm having to relearn the order of which button to push next. I forgot it all.
Well, nice to have you back anyway.
Thanks.
Mr. West, I was wondering, what's the current state of the Giza Plateau right now? Is there truth to there being a huge electrical fence? And is it true also that there's a McDonald's on the site?
We have a terrible connection here, actually, Kevin. I can't hear what this gentleman is saying.
He wants to know, is it true that, number one, at Giza Plateau there is now an electrical fence? And is it true that there is a McDonald's on the site now?
Not quite, but close. There is. It's not an electrical fence. There's a big fence around that's supposed to be for security. It's sort of like the Great Wall of Zahi. And yes, it's a very ugly 10-foot-high fence, supposedly for security reasons. I don't see what the hell they need security for around there, but that's what it's supposed to be for. And outside the fence in the little village that's nearby, where, you know, it's just a touristy village where you buy souvenirs and stuff, yes, there's a McDonald's. But that is what all of us have learned to call progress.
Thank you very much, Mr. West. Awesome show, Kevin.
All right. Thanks for the call. 623-444-5889. That's the number to call. John.
Yes.
The specificity of the layout of these massive structures.
Right.
The preciseness. This would indicate they had to have some kind of measuring tools.
Sure did.
That were very precise.
Yep.
What do you know anything about those tools?
As far as anybody knows, they're very simple tools. There's, you know, the Mason square and the plumb bob, and you see how they oriented things, and they somehow got it precise to the kind of precision that, let's say, modern-day surveyors use. But even more amazing is the precision of the stonework itself. In other words, do you know who Chris Dunn is?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Dunn? Yeah.
And, well, Chris, you know, Chris is... Mm-hmm. I don't necessarily agree with his conclusions, but I absolutely... I'm deeply impressed by let's say his investigative work, in which, I mean, he's a guy who, I forget exactly what his credentials are. He's an engineer, but it's the kind of engineer that he designs the machines that make the stuff for space shuttles, that kind of thing. So it's the highest level of precision machines. And he's been on a couple of my trips measuring the tolerances of stonework. And he's got these special measuring, very expensive measuring sticks, measuring rods, whatever they are, that are designed to measure down to, I think it's a 10,000th of an inch. In other words, if it's off by a 10,000th of an inch, light will come through. You'll see the discrepancy. So we're looking at big blocks of granite that are precise to a 10,000th of an inch. I mean, this is the kind of stuff that you use for eyeglasses or for Ferraris or something like that. So, I mean, nobody, I mean, we wouldn't begin to know how to, much less want to, make stonework precise to a 10,000th of an inch. But in Egypt, this is routine. They're finishing things to unbelievable tolerances. And Chris, confronted by this, is convinced that they had some kind of advanced high-tech method of doing this, since that's what we would need. But it's not that I dismiss that, but there's no evidence for it. And you know, there's a lot of evidence for stuff from Egypt. We know a lot about Egyptian technology, but we don't, when it comes to the crunch, we don't know how they built the pyramids, and we don't know how, really, we don't know how they finished these things. I mean, an obelisk, for example, is a 300, 400, 500-ton single block of stone that they pull out of the bedrock in Aswan and ship down the river somehow or another, a couple of hundred miles to Luxor. Well, strangely enough, through the work of a couple of friends of mine that I've been working with over the years, to my own satisfaction anyway, I can explain and I can show people, basically, when we're there on site, in Aswan at the ancient quarry. By the way, you know, we didn't mention this, but I do these Egypt trips, these high intensive study tours, so all of the things that we're talking about, you can actually, you know, sign on to one of my trips and experience it for yourself. And did you give my URL, jawest.com?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and your picture is on my site. Oh, okay. Is linked. That's to fine. Your site.
Okay, but anyway, so we can explain to our own satisfaction, and believe me, we're pretty skeptical about those things, how very simple technologies would allow them to pull these giant blocks out of the bedrock, get them from the quarry, load them onto rafts or boats, float them down the river, and then even get them up into place. More or less, we're reasonably happy with an explanation of genius, let's say genius expertise applied to, you know, quite simple looking technology. But then, how they finish it to those ten thousandths of an inch tolerances, how they actually cut the precise hieroglyphs into this very hard stone, granite for the most part, we don't know that. I mean, it doesn't seem possible with copper tools, and yet it's been done somehow. So there are loads everywhere you turn in Egypt, and the same applies in other civilizations. It's just that, you know, with the Maya, the Nazca lines in Peru, certain of the, even, you know, China and India, it's all over the place, particularly Mesoamerica with Tico and Machu Picchu. But it's in Egypt that there's so much of it, and enough is understood through the symbolist interpretation so that even though lots and lots of those technological questions remain, you can make a coherent sense of the basic civilization, which is very satisfying. In other places, you can't do that. You just go there and marvel at it, but you don't know what the devil, why they're doing it, or anything.
You know, one of the things that I think about when I think about, you know, these copper tools, and, you know, we know that if you take those tools today, you can't cut granite.
No.
With that. I mean, you know, you can't. All right, so here we've got artifacts that are done, so we know obviously somehow it was done, and then we say, well, they didn't have anything but copper tools.
Right.
Well, we have to understand that can't be true. So what we're looking at is we're looking at a civilization that had copper tools. That can't be the civilization that did these things.
No, well, it can be, but maybe it wasn't the copper tools that did it. They had some other way of doing it.
Well, there you go. That's true. That's true.
Some way of using the copper tools. It seems to be pretty well established that they were able to temper the copper to make it much harder, somehow or another with arsenic. I'm not exactly sure how they do that. It sounds a bit dangerous to me. But it's still copper. It's not as though it's titanium or or diamond or something like that. No, the more this is... One of the interesting bits about Egypt is that the deeper you go into it and the more you know, the more mysterious it gets.
All right. We have to step away for break. We'll be back with John Anthony West right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening, John Anthony West, and we're talking about some pretty mysterious stuff. And of course, we always know that we will be talking about mysterious stuff when we talk about ancient Egypt. Ancient Egypt. Let's go to the telephone line. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hey, this is Mike from Kentucky calling.
Hello, Mike.
Hey, Kevin. John Anthony, I talked to you once when you and Dr. Chalk were going to Egypt, and I told you about the idea that there were supposed to be secret tunnels underneath the pyramids and the Sphinx that joined, you know, each other together. And then you came back from that and said you had found something using ground radar under the paw of the Sphinx. Do you remember that?
Well, I don't remember the conversation, but yes, the... Our wasn't ground penetrating radar. It was the seismograph that seems to have discovered, anyway, a void, a chamber. We think it's a chamber, and where Edgar Cayce, the great psychic, said that the Hall of Records was supposed to be. But he acquired his knowledge through channeling, and our seismograph doesn't channel, but it provides hard data, and there seems to be such a chamber of some sort under the left paw of the Sphinx. It could be a natural formation, but it's not that kind of limestone that's riddled with what are called karst features. So until otherwise demonstrated, we think it is in fact some sort of a chamber. However, our seismographs did not determine, because we were being chased around all over the plateau trying to get our work done, we were not able to discover a passageway that leads into it, and if it is a man-made chamber, there should be something leading into it. And also, perhaps more to the point, it's the chamber, or the void, whatever it is under about 15 feet of bedrock. So, and that's, nowadays, that's below the water table level. So if it is really a chamber and there's something in it, it's going to be full of water. And so, interesting as it is, for us, it's on a back burner, because getting permission to do any kind of work there from any alternative point of view is difficult enough to begin with. And in this case, the authorities even have a good case to make, because it is arguably the most sensitive, politically the most sensitive archaeological spot on the planet. And to try to figure out what's in there, if anything, or indeed if it is really a chamber, which we're pretty sure it is, but you know, go argue. Even if you stuck down, you drilled little holes and stuck down fiber optic cameras, if it's all underwater, the chances are that they wouldn't discover anything anyway. And to actually excavate would mean that would be hugely expensive and actually quite dangerous for the security of the Sphinx. You'd have to dig a hole and put in a cofferdam, in other words, something that would keep the water out and pumps to pump the water out faster than it was coming in to find out if there's anything there. So for us, this is on a back burner. We're interested in the moment, at the moment, in proving that the geology is correct. All of the things I've been talking about, Göbekli Tepe, all of this relates to that. And if at a certain point we make our point so convincingly that even the quackademic establishment is obliged to agree with us, or at least not argue, at that point, maybe then it's time to reopen the question of, hey, let's figure out a way to get down into what our seismographs tell us is a chamber. Until then, there's no point even worrying about it. We concern ourselves with things that are, let's say, within the range of possibilities. And at the moment, excavating that or getting into it to find out what's there is not possible. So why bother? You know, why get concerned about it?
Kevin, one more question,
yes,
if I may.
Mm-hmm.
John Anthony, what would be the possibility, because some of the hieroglyphs tend to indicate that they may have had some type of electricity in ancient Egypt, and if they did, what would be the chances that they could have created arc lights, arc-like torches, and created diamond saw blades and things?
No, there isn't. Actually, no, there's no evidence that there's electricity. If you're talking about that one set of hieroglyphs, not of hieroglyphs, of reliefs in the crypt of Dendera that some people think is a cathode ray tube, it really isn't anything of the sort. And believe me, if they had anything like electricity at any kind of an advanced level, any kind of our sort of technology, we would have, you know, that we have a lot of stuff from ancient Egypt. I mean, along with the so-called cathode ray tube at Dendera are the reliefs on one of the architraves, one of the lintels, rather, at Abydos, where the New Ages think it's a helicopter. Well, it's not a helicopter. If it were a helicopter presupposes an advanced and complicated metallurgy. I mean, you can't have a helicopter without having advanced smelting techniques and machinery to make blades, all of these kinds of things. We know a lot about ancient Egyptian stuff. I mean, there are a lot of things that are still mysterious, but it's next to impossible that if they were done by any kind of technology that is to us recognizable, we'd have found evidence of it. It may be that they have some other form of technology that we don't understand at all, and that's what produces it. But electricity, in our sense, definitely not. And those supposed cathode ray tubes are very easy to explain as symbolic cosmological symbols, and it's next to impossible to do with a couple of minutes of verbal contact over the telephone. But if you're there in Dendera on a trip, I can show you in 2 seconds why it's not a cathode ray tube. But it's hard to do over the phone, so you're not obliged to take my word for it, but I'd be perfectly happy if it were a cathode ray tube. In other words, finding advanced technology in Egypt would be in my own interest, but the evidence isn't there for it. So.
All right, Mike, thanks for the call. We have a flash message from Kevin in Australia. He's got three questions. I'm going to take the first one and the third one because we don't have time to take all three. How far back do you think the human race has inhabited the Earth?
You know, I don't know. I have no idea. The physical evidence keeps getting pushed back, so that, you know, now it's a few million years. If you take a Lucy and Kenya, wherever it is, the old divide things. But you know, if you take seriously, or you, let's say if you accept the possibility that the ancient, the Vedas, the Hindu literature is correct, and I don't think it's correct, and I don't necessarily think that it's incorrect, but it's a possibility, and who am I to contradict them? It may go back many, many millions of years beyond that. But even in terms of what we call sophisticated civilization keeps getting pushed back and back and back. So now it's at least a few hundred thousand years. And recently, a couple of months ago, they discovered that, and how exactly dating, I'm not sure, but at least 200,000 years ago, there was sea travel of getting to, I think it's Cyprus or Rhodes, one of the Greek islands, and they found, you know, boats that had got there from mainland, from North Africa. So, you know, if they're traveling by boat in 200,000 B.C., you know, this is not, you know, these are not monkeys just down off the trees. It's not easy to do that.
And that brings up his second question.
Right.
But here's what I want to do. Let's go to the telephone. Let's take this call, and we'll come back to this flash message and that second question after this call. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hi, Kevin. This is Ryan in Washington.
Hi, Ryan.
It's good to have you back on the air.
Thank you.
Is there any significance with regarding Egypt, Giza, and the pyramids that correlates to this time period that we're in, as far as since we're passing through the center of the Milky Way galaxy, that points towards anything in Giza that or Egypt that has any significance to this time period or 2012?
It's a good question, actually. Not that I know of. I mean, I think that Boval's theory that the Giza Plateau is laid out and represents the constellation of Orion is fundamentally correct, although there are all kinds of complicating factors about it. But whether or not there's anything, let's say, specifically relating to this period now when we're, what is it? You just said it. We're the solstice is a, what is it?
Well, we're passing, we're beginning to pass through the galactic medium.
Right, right.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, but given the level of astronomical knowledge available to them, it wouldn't surprise me if it were there, but if it is there, I don't know about it.
All right. Ryan, thanks so much for the call. Let's see. I'm going to his second question in this flash message, Kevin in Australia, instead of his third. Because you were saying, you know, with boats 200,000 years ago, these were not monkeys standing around out there.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so here's his second question. I'm sorry, third question. John, why has it become such a ridiculed experience from mainstream sciences to question the theory of evolution these days? And are we in reformation again, once again?
Yeah. You mean if you question Darwinian evolution, you're automatically discounted as a fundamentalist Christian? Is that the?
I think that's what he's saying. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you got to understand it's a question that is not difficult to answer, but it's difficult to answer in a couple of lines. All of these people who get so upset when somebody questions their stupid theory of evolution. All of these people are deeply religious themselves, but the religion is called the Church of Progress, And its underlying dogma is that everything is an accident and that our lives are meaningless. So that anybody who questions this theory, which is actually, I like to call the cargo cult of the West, and I don't even mean that as an insult. I mean it as an exact analogy. Nobody argues, except for crazy creationist fundamentalists, that evolution is a process, that it is an accidental process, that it just happens like that through a series of amazing accidents. This is not demonstrated, and in fact, is undemonstrable. By definition, it cannot be demonstrated. So how can you prove that something is an accident? There may always be intelligence there. I mean, I write a book.
John, we have to step away for break. Caller, if you will, hang on. We'll get you right after the break. We'll be back, folks. Back to the Kevin Smith Show. We're on final approach, folks. That means we only have a few minutes left. And John, do you want to take this call now, or you want to finish the thought about evolution?
Oh, I'll just finish it quickly, actually, that this is a big, big subject. And Robert Schock, my colleague, and I are, one of these days, we're determined to write the definitive anti-Darwin book. But until then, it's a very complicated issue, but the question was, why do they get so upset? The reason they get so upset is that any contradiction of their doctrine of accident and meaninglessness basically upsets it. It actually destroys their confidence in the meaninglessness of their own lives. So anybody who suggests that it isn't that way upsets them, because here they think that they're completely useless and meaningless. And somebody is coming along and saying, well, maybe you are, but I'm not.
Yeah, that's it. But, you know, I often say, folks, Darwin is dead, and so is his theory.
But his theory isn't.
Well, anyway, his theory actually is, in my opinion, a dead theory. It's finished. Stick a fork in it. Some form of evolution is possible, but the Darwin model is a failed model, and he even said so.
More or less,
yeah. All right, let's take this call. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Yes, Kevin. This is Steve. This is Steve in Fort Worth.
Yeah, Steve.
I got a question for John. I was, you know, the Egyptians, I mean, they were around for like, you know, 3,000 years. I mean, they had plenty of time to develop higher learning. And my question is like, you know, in the early dynasties, they had a practice where they would elongate the skulls, and that continued on through some other, you know, up to the last dynasty, up into the Amenhoteps, and then so forth and so on. But do you think that this practice could have been a catalyst for higher learning?
No, actually, it's not. No, that if you're referring to those strange elongated skulls of the Akhenaten period. I mean, that's unique. I mean, that's not before Akhenaten, and it's not after Akhenaten. And nobody knows what the devil that is about. You can't, in other words, in Africa, or other cultures as well, they have way of, they board up, they put plates on the heads of little babies when the bones are still pliable, and it elongates their skulls in a certain way, but not that way, not where it's narrow at the front, or let's say normal at the front, and then comes back into the strange bulbous shape. Nobody knows. And they certainly weren't doing that early on. So it's an anomaly. It's a strange thing that happens in the equally mysterious period of Akhenaten, and nobody knows why. I mean, sometimes people say, oh, John, well, of course, everyone knows why. It's they're aliens. Well, I can't dismiss that they're aliens, but there's no evidence that they were aliens. The evidence is that for this brief period of a couple of a generation, really, all of a sudden the artwork changed, and you have these people, including the king and himself, but all of his courtiers and everybody in that period, with these strange, elongated, misshaped, but not inelegant, heads. And beyond that, I don't know. I can't say. But certainly it was not there from the beginning.
All right, Steve. Thank you.
Categorically not.
Thank you, Steve. And that brings up a flash message from Ireland. This one also from someone named Kevin in Ireland. And it says, is there...
Kevin.
I'm sorry?
I said everyone in Ireland's named Kevin.
Well, yeah. Well, it's a good name, you know. Is there any connection with aliens to these ancient pyramids? And that you just brought that up.
No, it's, put it this way. I don't... The UFO phenomenon is for sure real. The evidence is commanding. Whether or not that's... So I don't dismiss that for Egypt. However, it is my least favorite scenario. In other words, how did they build these things? And then you can't figure out how they did it. So you say, well, it must have been aliens. But if it's aliens, well, how did they get so smart? So there's no evidence for it. As I said, I don't dismiss it, but I prefer to think that it was beings ostensibly like ourselves, but with different priorities and in certain ways far more intelligent and advanced than ourselves. And for them, for whatever reason, well, it enhanced, if we take as a given that the immortality of the soul was their objective. So these are devices for enhancing that quest. I'm quite happy with that as an explanation, but I can't give specifics. Everything in Egypt is directed toward that aim. That's for sure. Even the academics wouldn't disagree with that. They just say that, well, as an aim, that's ridiculous because we all know that Darwin was right and we live, we die, and that's the end of it.
You did a video series where you talk about the sacred science of ancient Egypt. And it's a fascinating series. Is that series still available out there?
Oh, yeah, you can get it from me, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Or you can get it, you can go online, Magical Egypt, the Symbolist Tour. It's available, and as I said, I have them and I sell them. It's not, unfortunately, it's not for sale at your local Walmart checkout counter, but it's there.
Mm-hmm. So if people want to get your books, if they want to get your videos, they need to go to your website.
Website, the books you can get on Amazon as well, but you get them from me and I sign them. So.
Okay. So the books include Serpent in the Sky, the High Wisdom of Ancient Egypt.
And The Traveler's Key to Ancient Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
And the videos are the one with Charlton Heston, the Emmy Award one. Mystery of the Sphinx, which is about the Sphinx theory, and then the eight episode set, Magical Egypt, the Symbolist Tour, which is, if you can't get to Egypt personally and see it for yourself, it's probably the next best way to actually experience it. My partner in that is a absolute genius 3D animator and media guy, and he's really put together an extraordinary show on a shoestring budget.
All right. We don't have but about 30 seconds here until I have to start bringing us in for a landing. But let me just ask you in a very brief answer. Many people think that this guy, Liedskalnin, that built the Coral Castle, discovered the secrets by which the pyramids had been built, cutting and moving massive blocks, worked entirely by himself. What do you think about that?
Well, he thought he rediscovered the secrets of the ancient Egyptians, but since nobody knows what those secrets are, you can't say. What you can say is that he discovered something that allowed him to do something that we don't know how he did it, and it could well be that it's the same. That it's the same method, but since he never told anybody what it was, nobody knows. But it's absolutely fantastic work that he did.
I think it proves that whatever was possible still is.
Well, that's if you're making that argument, that's a good chunk of argument. Yes,
yeah.
I would agree with that.
Wouldn't it be exciting if we could discover the way they thought that enabled them to technologically do what they did?
Yes, it would. You bet.
Just imagine what we could accomplish if we coupled that with what we know of science today.
Well, maybe, but you know, that's only the physical aspect of it.
Mm-hmm.
You don't need a technology to be spiritually advanced.
Oh, that's true. That's true. But think if we could think like they thought, and bring that into, for instance, finding a cure for cancer or something like that.
Well, or something of the sort. But the how shall I put it? The technology is not necessary to be civilized. In other words, you can have a civilization where they build nothing and they express themselves purely through sacred dance.
John, I hate to do it, but the music's playing and our mics are going dead here in just a few seconds. We've reached the end of the show. Thank you for being with me this evening. It's been fascinating. Stay on the line with me for just a moment. Ladies and gentlemen, that's it. That's a wrap for this evening. My friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do too. You can call me whatever you want. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time, so long, everybody.